The Balut Kiki Project is a proud member of Bunk Collective. This Balut Kiki Project contains themes, depictions, and language of an adult and mature nature. Listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed in this project are not meant to replace the advice of professionals. Thank you.
Another project here on the Balut Kiki Project. Thank you for clicking play and tuning into our podcast. If this is your first time listening to us, welcome. I am Mel, and this is my friend Jeff.
Thank you, Mel. The recent and timely deaths of Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, and of Robin Williams, all from apparent depression-related suicides, came as a surprise to many of us. To us as well, Mel, even to a lot of Filipinos like us, because we were all thinking, how could a sikat na fashion designer and a successful businesswoman known for her fabulous creations, how could a chef who's traveled the world and who showed an incredible love for life, a TV personality, how could a comedian, an Oscar winner, dubbed the funniest man alive, I'm so adept at making people laugh at his jokes and his impressions, how can all these very successful, rich people be depressed enough to end their own lives? The truth is, Mel, that 8 out of 100,000 Filipinos commit suicide. Of this figure, 6 are males, while 2 are females, and aged 15 to 29, so young people. And the number of deaths due to self-harm, due to suicide, have increased by about a quarter in 2020. So tumataas pa siya, making suicide the 27th leading cause of death in the Philippines. Wow. And Mel, they say that for each person who dies by suicide, that person leaves behind an estimated 6 or more suicide survivors. And when I say suicide survivors, these are people who have lost someone that they care deeply about and are left grieving and struggling to understand.
We would like to welcome to the program one such person, Mr. Richard Wicks, who will bravely share with us his story as a father who has gone through perhaps what is one of the most difficult things any parent can ever go through, and that is to lose a child to suicide. Thank you very much for volunteering your story with our Filipino listeners, Richard. This means a lot to this podcast and to us personally.
Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think about a year into the grieving process, I made a decision that if I was to give my daughter's life, death meaning in a positive way, that I would talk about suicide and stop. No, I can't stop it. But I mean, there's a certain taboo that we're terribly, terribly afraid of talking about suicide. And yet, as a psychologist, I also know that the more we've talked about sex education, the less sexually transmitted diseases, the less unwanted pregnancies happen. And when we teach people about drugs, we get only positive results in that there's people are much more educated about the dangers of drugs and the use goes down and so on. So why would that not translate to suicide? For me, it's certainly worth a try. And it's certainly as taboo as sex and drugs, if not more. So, you know, I just feel like you're giving me an opportunity by speaking today to share something which gives my daughter's life and the way she decided to end her life meaning. So just shoot your questions. I don't know where you want me to start.
Yeah. You say you worked as a psychologist?
I have a degree as a psychologist. Okay. I've really worked in the field of healing. So it was, for me, I was in a totally different profession, and I started feeling under instruction of a Chinese master, the energy inside other people's bodies, kind of like psychic healing. Mm-hmm. And then I taught Kung Fu in Germany for many years, lived in Germany for about 16 years. Lived in then Hong Kong for 12. And in Hong Kong, I felt that I should really work on more the medical area. And then I worked much more, as I say, with the healing sides. And it was really my daughter's death, her suicide, which brought me back to say, I'm kind of in denial of, the fact that our energy is continuous, like who you are. If I say, who are you? For me, it's not about what you wear. It's not about even what your body looks like. It's your energy. That's who you are at the end of the day. Because all of the other things, and include actually your energy is going to change. So I'm not sure I really answer the question of who we really are. But so, you know, we're going to change so much. But essentially, something that I can work on, if you like, purifying, and something which is going to live after my death is my energy. And that's that's my understanding and experience. It is funny because there's a number of pretty sort of psychic experiences that I have with my daughter. So my daughter Emma was very, very close to me. And I think there was a connection which was always a psychic connection, which I had with her. And in a way, that was such a surprise that I hadn't picked up that she was doing so badly. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like 3 days before she took her life, I talked to her. And I didn't get that impression. But I was also somebody who I put a brave face on things. Do you know what I mean? And we tend to think that people that are healers or people who are psychic, that they don't have mental health problems. But, you know, I was definitely suffering from depression. I've suffered from it twice in my life. And I didn't realize the first time it was totally just, I just don't have the energy that I used to have. Since a specific event, and then after Emma's death, and after having studied psychology, which I did as a mature student, I was like, right, okay, this is depression. I have depression. I have a physiological depression. So, like something which is a healthy form, it's not a sick form, as it were. That's what we call. I mean, it's just a word that we use. Yeah, we call 6 months of depression after a loss totally normal. It's not considered sick. That's like, yeah, you should do that. It would be pathological not to grieve. It would be pathological not to be depressed.
You said that you're pretty close with your daughter, Emma. I was wondering if you would be willing to share what your daughter might have been like as a child prior to all this.
Well, she was, I would say she was a daddy's girl. She was very, I think, you know, dads have a very special relationship with their daughters. There's something, you know, really special about being a father to a girl, because this is like your princess. This is somebody who you, in a way, you look down to and look up to, you know, at the same time. And, you know, I'm very lucky to have two wonderful daughters. And I always talk about Emma in the present tense, although she's no longer walking around, I still feel that she's here. And I decided that when she died, I said, I'm not going into the past tense. I'm not going to say I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. Instead of I have two daughters, I still have two daughters. Mm-hmm. I will always have two daughters. And I think just very creative, very sensitive, deep feeling girl, very much, you know, felt her feelings as she grew older. One of my regrets is moving over to, because of financial difficulties, I moved out of Germany to Hong Kong, and I had to leave the kids who were already living with their mom. I was about, you know, 2 kilometers away. So we'd meet, you know, every day. They'd have every other weekend with me and so on. So we were really, really in close contact. But because of business, actually, it was kind of weird because it was just before the 2008 financial meltdown that I said, okay, I think I have to get out of here. My business is going to go completely belly up. And I went to Hong Kong because I already had my Kung Fu family in Hong Kong. So I was going to learn Kung Fu in Hong Kong and I was going to come back when things were looking better. But that was the plan. But Emma was, what, 13? Not a great time, you know, 14. So not a great time in a young girl's life for her dad to leave. And I, you know, I think I wish I could have done it differently. I don't see also how I don't see any other options. You know, in retrospect, I think I made the right decision, but I think I still could. I go back and I think, could I have done any better?
Yeah.
And I do think of ways I could have done it better. I think that was very, very difficult for her. Extremely difficult for her. So they were coming to Hong Kong, you know, sort of as often as we could afford it, but still that wasn't the same. And I think she really struggled with that. And we know from psychology, we know these issues, which Bowlby and Ainsworth developed something called the attachment theory. And that when the children feel we have a fear of abandonment, of being left alone. And of course that leaves a scar. So to a certain extent, without knowing it, I hadn't studied psychology at the time, I'd given, you know, my children a certain trauma, you know, which would affect them emotionally. There's that. And I think, yeah, Emma was really a daddy's girl and she really was emotionally affected by it.
You mentioned the word guilt, Richard. I mean, the loss of a loved one brings about intense mourning. Personally, I lost my mom. I was a mama's boy. I lost her in 2012, but I still consider myself a brokenhearted son to this very day. She literally died in my arms. Having been a nurse for 15 years, I was witness to death many, many times over. I was the designated palliative resource nurse in our ward in my last assignment before I retired my license. I've witnessed people die because of bombings and gunfire and as casualties of an ongoing civil war. So I've been witness to quiet deaths. I've been witness to violent deaths. But thinking about this and preparing for this episode, a death by suicide, the emotions experienced, I can just imagine, you know, the aftermath can differ considerably from those following other types of death. But unlike a sudden accident, Richard, you know, the people that have been left behind to grapple with it, the death having been such a deliberate act, and people grieve, they cope with the loss, but also painful questions I can imagine as to why the suicide occurred. And you brushed very briefly about that many people experience guilt about whether the death could have been prevented.
Well, I have to really. Again, it makes my story a little bit special. Again, it's just the story, the true story of what happened. Before Emma died, for weeks and weeks and weeks, I had a bad tummy. I had real difficulty eating. So I felt that was an aura of things to come, but I didn't know. I just had a bad tummy. And I found the only place I could go was a vegetarian Buddhist restaurant that just had this lovely, peaceful space in Hong Kong. And I'd go there and I'd eat like, and I'd feel like everything's so painful in my gut, so painful. And one day I sat down, it was actually 2 weeks before her death. I sat down and I meditated. And I was brought up a Christian. You know, after becoming educated, I became more of a Taoist. And, you know, I would go down to the temples and pray to Guangong and Guanyin. I just saw them as, I can relate with these as well. So I didn't have a problem. And really, I was very much, you know, a lapsed Christian, you might say, but not negative, not I don't like Christianity, but so I meditated on that day and I just felt like it was like the doors were shut. It's like I couldn't enter this state that I'd been taught to enter, and I was practiced in entering. That's day one. So I did it the next day, same thing. day two. It's like I literally felt, you know, when shops have the metal shutters, the rollers, yeah. and they rolled down. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm not allowed in. And I mean, I'm shut out. I'm like, that's weird. And I just ignored it. On the third day, I'm sat down. I'm thinking, you know, why am I doing this? It hasn't worked for 2 days. But I sat down and this man appeared with the beard. And I can't say, people say, did you like have a physical apparition of somebody in front of you? And I said, never in my life have I had that. But I knew somebody was there and he had a beard and he said, you're forgiven. And well, that's amazing. I could feel like something happen in my body. Like, oh, I said, that's amazing. How did you do that? He said, it's all very easy. So it wasn't like, you know, my room filled with light and there was trumpets and there were angels. It was just like, there's this man. He's very down to earth. He just goes, oh, you're forgiven. And then he goes. And 2 weeks later, my daughter died. So I consider it was, for me, Jesus is the forgiver. Yeah. It's like, that's his, you know, that's his thing. Mm-hmm. And that I'd been prepared psychically for, because I think the guilt would have killed me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, no, you're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Actually, Jeff, I wanted to say, I hope this doesn't sound awful, but I would give so much to hold my daughter and kiss her goodbye when she died than to just got the news that she'd been in this terrible, perhaps psychotic kind of state when she took her own life. It might not sound very nice, but I look at like the ability to hold somebody's hand and tell them you love them and let them, you know, slip into another dimension of our existence would be a gift. Because it was so, so difficult to even, psychically come in touch, get in touch with Emma. Because I did, after she died, I tried to, there's a few stories that happened after she died. I mean, it's just, I was inconsolable. So when you talk about trauma, when I got the news, I got it on the phone and my body just stood up. So I don't say I stood up, my body just like, do you know, we have the patella tendon reflex, so that when there's suddenly a hole in the ground, your legs will straighten. So if you miss a step, your legs are automatically going to straighten. Mm-hmm. So it was like the world was taken from underneath me and my whole body just shot up to stand up to protect me. And I was in the middle of a restaurant in Hong Kong, and I just like stood up and I was standing, like moved out of the stall and was standing in the gangway of the restaurant. Just what, you know, and I think there's something which has been described by the grief researchers. I'm thinking of Kubler-Ross. It's like this.
Dabda.
It's can't believe, you know, disbelief.
It's denial. You
know, yeah, denial. This can't be. But I know it's true, but it can't be. And
do you mind me asking, Richard, what you were told in that phone call?
Yeah. I mean, kind of weird. I got a phone call at 4 a.m. from my ex-wife on Skype, and I'm like, she's forgotten the time difference. I'm not going to answer this. I'm going to sleep. I just didn't think it could be anything. I didn't think it could be an emergency. So, and I had a very nice, actually, Filipina part-time cleaner. Came over and she's doing the house. I'm chatting and I'm saying, yeah. And it suddenly occurs to me, oh, I should, if my ex has called at this time, then maybe it's important that at least I could do is return the call. But it was about 10 a.m. So it must have been about 4 a.m., 3 a.m. In Germany, which is where I'd lived before. And where Emma had lived, and I'm like, immediately she's on the phone. I'm like, well, that's strange. And she said, Emma tried to hang herself, and I thought, okay, that's not good. She tried to. I mean, she hasn't succeeded. I said, well, that's not good. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got some work to do. She said, no. She did it. She succeeded.
Oh, no.
And it's really weird because I said, it was an accident. She didn't mean to. Mm-hmm. She changed her mind, but she couldn't. She didn't know how to stop it. I just knew there was this moment, and I've had these experiences in my own life of thinking I can't go on, and thinking, well, that very first suicidal ideation, and then going, well, why? you know, like, what is there? It's like the ego falls away, but doesn't want to face things, and our deeper self comes up to shine and says, everything's fine. Yeah. At this second, you can breathe, you can see, and there's so much going for you. Everything's fine. And I'd experienced that. So I felt like she'd had that moment just before she died that this, a lot of this drama that she created or had been created, you know, with her being a co-creator of it, just fell away. And she knew, no, I want to live. So I told her mum that. Probably didn't help. And then I said, well, you know, I'll have to get back and come for the funeral.
Mm-hmm. This was 5 years ago, Richard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You said 5 years. Yeah. And how old was Emma?
21. So mm-hmm. she was a baby, really. But she was a child. But of course, she's, you know, an adult. She was at university. Mm-hmm. And she was a bit socially isolated, as I understand. So she was in a shared student accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So they rented a whole house. Happens a lot in Germany, mm-hmm. like a commune kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But she was on the top floor, and apparently they were a little bit. I mean, her words kind of stuck up. So mm-hmm. she didn't really fit in with the people that she was living. So there was a certain social isolation there, and then. She didn't really like her course. So she mm-hmm. was doing a course at Bremen University in speech therapy mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Philosophy. She liked the philosophy, but the speech therapy was definitely sort of not anything that she really. So I was saying, you know, just change, you know, come to Hong Kong, study psychology with me, or, you know, do something different. And then she had, so this was a little girl that. In her summer holidays at like 15, she'd spend her summer holidays at the animal shelter, helping animals mm-hmm. that had been abandoned and do it for free. So just that mm-hmm. was what she wanted to spend her holidays doing. This is such a lovely person that she is. And she'd volunteered in Bremen to help this disabled person. Apparently they were very negative. They were just miserable and negative. So she wasn't enjoying that at all. And it's okay, but not everybody's a saint with their suffering. You know, some people, you know, they're disabled and they want mm-hmm. to make sure everybody pays that they're disabled.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to apportion blame because I, mm-hmm. you know, how can I do that? I can say these are factors. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Trying to examine, you know, the rear view mirror and trying to look for clues.
Yeah, the real for me, the rear view mirror, she was in a relationship that was a little bit toxic, I believe.
Oh, okay.
And somebody much older, not much older, they were like 10 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it would be like literally like the day before before she took her life, he said, "Oh, you know, if you're not going to marry me, then I'll finish with you," which is kind of like, you know, a gun to the head anyway.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the whole family didn't like him. And basically he'd isolated her from all of her friends. He told, oh, this friend's no good and that friend's no good. Mm. And she was too young to know that that's, you know, very much, you know, the narcissistic abusive relationship pattern. And I didn't know that it was happening. I didn't really click until afterwards, and I heard enough things that, you know, her really good friends that were always there, he sort of picked on them and said, they're not good for you and that's not good for you, and he was a psychologist. What can I say? No, I mean, well, I've got to say I don't blame him. I actually don't blame him. I think, you know, we all go through our our journey, and we all have our learning. Do I think he's an asshole? Yeah, I think he's an asshole. Sorry, excuse my an a-hole. yes, sure. For not just one reason, but I'm not going to hold it against them. I think everybody's got their learning. You know, have I been an a-hole? Yes. So,
For two people who recently, we've been very open in this project, in this podcast, from the get-go, at the pilot, we admitted that Mel and I separately, but around the same time last year, we both had attempts. Yeah, happy anniversary.
I know.
had attempts to take our own lives. What people don't understand is that, you know, these suicides, or at least attempts at suicide, are not preceded by a large flashing yellow light and bold signs that state, like, you know, warning, danger ahead. Because I think the question that a lot of people want to ask survivors or the families who have been left behind by people who committed suicide were almost accusatory, like, didn't you see weren't you aware of any clues, the signs? And the thing is that families, survivors, don't simply choose to bypass those signs, take a detour, and treat somebody else's depression and anxiety simply as a bump in the road that you can just plow through. You know what I mean? But I understand that these questions might sound accusatory.
No, I mean, also, I'm kind of, I think it's a nice serendipity. Emma committed suicide in September as well.
Suicide prevention month?
Yeah. maybe, yeah.
And irony is not lost on me.
Yeah.
Which is perfect that you said yes now, Richard, because we're going to release this episode. People are hearing this in Suicide Prevention Month. So thank you very much.
I mean, you know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, I felt that Emma would be proud of me talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of like, okay, we're not going to talk about it. That's the failure of the family and committed suicide. That's bullshit. Excuse my French. That's nonsense.
We speak French here. Don't worry, Richard.
Very friendly.
A lot of French.
Like, when I understood it, okay, so number one is what I understand about suicide as far as a psychologist, you know, after the fact, is it comes on like a rushing train, like something you have to do, and you have to do it immediately, you have to do it now. My own thoughts when I have had suicidal ideation, and I think that's, like, you know, something I'm okay to admit, it was, I'd be doing everyone else a favor. And then as a survivor, no, you're not. No, believe it. Believe me, you've given us something way, way, way more difficult now, I think. I think when the suicidal ideation comes on, I've been very lucky in my work, again, also inspired by Emma, but also before, I would ask people, so, you know, when I'm doing an intake, you know, so how are you feeling? Do you feel like you're happy most of the time or not? And they say, well, I'm not happy. I said, well, you know, do you ever think about ending your life? Okay. And when people have said, not once, yeah, it has happened. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I think about ending my life. And so I'd say, the next question is to say, well, do you think about it in a concrete way? Like, exactly how would you do it? You know, what
do you have a plan?
Take? Mm-hmm. And what the more concrete the plan, the more often the thoughts, the more it's a medical emergency. So we have to consider it like that. It's like, you know, when if you've got you're being in a car accident and your leg's broken, and there's, you know, there's obviously somebody is really in danger of imminent death or imminent, like, serious self-harm, we can call the ambulance. Mm-hmm. However, the problem is with mental health is we don't see it. In fact, we socially we're trained to hide it. We'll go to work and we'll smile at everybody and very often you'll hear about people that once they've made that strong decision, they actually feel relief. They feel like, that's the end of things. And there've been more than one case of people, you know, police officers who've, you know, they've had the best day of their life and they're feeling so good, and then they'll go home and shoot themselves because they, it's like they've let go of everything. And really, so my experience was like, well, I'd let go of everything. I said, well, why can't I hold on to this, letting go of everything? Why can't I just be in this state of grace that everything is taken care of for me, really, in so many ways? And then for me, I got this message, like, but within minutes of hearing the news, I heard in my ears, like Emma was speaking to me, she said, Daddy, energy is real. I'm like, whoa. And I was like, well, I said, of course it's real. Like, I know that. And, but I felt, I did feel guilty because I felt like I hadn't really, I'd had these experiences, really practical, physical experiences of healing with this Taoist master in China. I'd done it myself. I was able to do it. I'd even shown other people how to feel energy and transfer energy and do it over a distance and all like really, really stuff that you just blew my mind at the time, which is, again, why I didn't talk about it. Because there's very much a stigma around mental health and being psychic. So once you say, I saw this that nobody else can see, people, you know, they get a little bit frightened by it.
Yeah.
Because they don't understand it.
Yeah. And there's implications, you know, what can you see about me that I don't want you to see? So then the next thing was, again, this really strange experience of grieving that I cried so much. My stomach was hurting. My stomach muscles were hurting. And I...
This was after you learned of the news.
Yes. Yes. It's like days after. And I am exhausted from the crying. And physically, my muscles are just exhausted from crying. And I can eat a meal a day. And I'm sleeping the rest of the time because I'm just physically exhausted. And I'm like, oh, I'm living on my own in Hong Kong. I don't have family in Hong Kong. I have friends. But
support.
See, the Chinese culture, if somebody dies, that's the message for everybody around you to give you space. And in a way, they don't want to get close to the death energy. And I was like, death energy, oh, stay away from that. It might be, we might commit suicide, you know, we might get infected by that. Yeah. So although what you need, you know, in depression and is social contact, social support, what you get is the opposite. So I thought, well, I'll message my friends. This is what's going on. And then you didn't hear anything from anybody. I'm like, oh, that was, I really wasn't expecting that. So it was like an intercultural, and I won't say it was anybody's mistake. I'm just like, it is what it is.
It is what, yeah.
But I did this, I had this thought. I said, I think part of my soul has gone to Deathland to be with Emma, because I really would like to be with Emma. I really would like to be dead with her, if I can be. I kept on, you know, and that's again Kubler-Ross. You know, can we trade? Can we the trade bargaining. Places? Can we bargain? You know, if I die, will she be able to live? Can I take care of her? My job is to take care of her, and I've let her down. I'll go and take care of her. That's my job. Anyway, so. I went to my spiritual guy, teacher, and we did some work on Emma. But I had this very clear feeling that part of me had said immediately, like, okay, I'm off. We call it soul fragment. So part of the soul said, okay, I'll go over there and I'll be in the Deathland. And I said, I've got no energy. So I did this little meditation where I said, okay, I'm going to get on my spirit animal. So it's a bit like a shamanic. It was, but I hadn't got any drums and I didn't light any fires or anything. I sat on my bed in a very small apartment in Kowloon in Hong Kong. And I said, okay, so I'm going to get on the wings of an owl and we're going to fly to Deathland. Just like imagine, okay, it's a flight by thing a long time. Fly, go to Deathland. And we're going to look for my soul. And there was just like this black, you know, blob on the ground. So the owl flew down, grabbed it and picked it up. And then we started flying back and we flew back and flew back and flew back. And it took ages. And eventually we got back. I said, okay, look, this part of my soul, I know you want to be dead. I know you want to be there, but I need you. I need you to be with me because otherwise I will die. Mm-hmm. So the weird thing is, after that, I stopped crying. And for about a week, whenever I fell asleep, my night's experience was from the moment I started to sleep through till I woke up was crying in my dreams. So I cried all night, but not physically. So I was able to then like physically help myself because I think I would have died from not being able to eat because there was nobody taking care of me. I knew it was just down to me. So that was for me a meaningful story. And it was before then, I think it was before I flew to Germany to meet up with her brother, her mom. And that's where another little miracle happened,
which
is a survival. Yeah. So my sister came over to Germany. My sister's from the UK as well, and my dad. And nobody knows what to say in these situations. I'll talk about that in a minute. I think people say the worst things without meaning to say the worst things. We'd spent the day, we'd gone to the marketplace. It's a beautiful town in Germany, a beautiful marketplace. I'd seen friends, but I just didn't want to talk to them because I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to say why I was there. I'd like almost ignore them. I mean, I did ignore them. I was like, I just can't. So, but I kept on thinking that I was going to see Emma. So I kept on seeing people and that's Emma. And then turn around and it's like, I'm not about, but I'm like, but she seems like she's here. It seems like she's just there. She's so like tangible. Like she is here, but she's not. Anyway, that was a sort of strange experience. My son had fallen into a depression and had thoughts of self-harm. So he'd gone and checked himself into the psychiatric hospital, where they didn't do a great job, I must say, but at least he was safe. And he suffers to this day with depression. Actually he's making progress. And we spent the day with him. We drove back, and we're driving back to Emma's childhood house, where her mum lived. And as we're driving back, the sky has got this beautiful, sort of orangey lilac color. It's a beautiful sky, not a cloud, except one, a single cloud, which is directly above Emma's old house. And it's in the shape of a wing. I kid you not. It couldn't be more of a beautiful artist's rendition of a wing. And I'm like, that's phenomenal. There are no clouds in the sky, and that there's this wing that when we drive home is directly over Emma's house. So anyway, I'm like, because I've done all this energy work and everything else, I'm like, that's not coincidence. So I went outside and I took some photographs of it, and that's my Facebook profile. So sometimes I put it to my Facebook profile. And I took photographs of it, and I took photographs. I feel like 10 minutes. I'm like, I want to stay here with this cloud as long as I can. And after about 10 minutes, I got a photo of it. No, it's like, okay, got a photo. I can go back in. So I went back in for about 2 minutes, and I went, I need to go out and be with it more.
Yeah.
It had gone. It had gone completely. I don't know if that's normal, but I've never seen that. I've never seen it. It's like it's there constantly for like 10 minutes. You can look up and see it. And for me, it was just like, it was an angel's wing, and it was a positive sign that, she's at that space. But I was still very, very far from being where I am now. It's more just feeling the love towards her. Just feel the love, which is why I can talk about it. And I did talk about it, a year after I did help with mine, but it was always so exhausting. I'd have to have a day off just because it's just like this is so exhausting. I wanted to mention, how people say the most inappropriate things.
Yeah.
Please.
They say, have you got another daughter? You got a spare? really?
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but I mean, the worst one, I think the worst one was really came from the doctor I was working with. He has a clinic in Hong Kong. I don't want to, score points off him, but I don't want to harm him in any way. But he was a doctor and he studied psychology as well. And he said, get over it. And, it was my failing for not being okay with this.
Yeah.
And I've been to his wedding. He was my friend. I was like, I must say, a little bit to my shame, I've never spoken to him again. I met his wife in the train station. I said, like, really? I know that's anybody that could say that. Apparently, like, the in a caring professions, like, I think they're fake. Or they've got a lot to learn, put it like that.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's fake. I guess we're all fake, you know. But
never go to a doctor whose office plants are dead. That's what I say.
Yeah.
This may be a good segue, Richard. You talked about culture and what other people say that might not be appropriate. With your permission and Mel's, I'd just like to cite, in the Philippines, just in 2020, just last year, they reported a 57.3% increase in suicide. And this is according to a report from the Philippine Statistics Office. And it's funny, Richard, that you talk about this. I was saying, this is a good segue, because government officials in the Philippines appealed to churches and spiritual leaders in the country to provide counsel and guidance to their followers to ease the anxiety and help save people from self-destruction during the pandemic, because people were apparently, you know, taking their lives, or, you know, the suicide rates have gone up. However, mental health groups in the Philippines and advocates criticized this call, and saying the calling for religious leaders to mainly address the issue is downright insulting to mental health professionals in the country, in the Philippines, especially when, and Mel, you will know this, this very religious institutions have created a long-held malicious narrative about mental health. And being Catholic and having been raised Catholic, we all know that people who commit suicide are sent to hell. And that there's I don't know if there are rumors, I don't know if things have changed, but when I was younger, we were actually, I heard that if you committed suicide, your body will not be able to enter a Catholic church. So there's a stigma.
It's the
that,
same
you know, today. It's your fault. And that, you know, and in order for the deaths to stop, I think people should realize it's not more than religion. I mean, it's good to have faith. It's good to be spiritual, whatever your religion is and whatever you call, however you define spirituality. But I think more than that, we need action. During the pandemic in the Philippines, we need free mass testing. There has to be social programs, unemployment insurance, increased subsidies for the poor, or just programs. In preparing for this episode, I was looking at other countries who had toll-free numbers that people could call if ever they needed help. And I'm just hoping against hope. There's some numbers in the Philippines, and it's available in our website as well, because this is what we want people to, this is why we're doing this. I mean, it's good to talk, but hopefully this will help somebody out there who's gone through what we've gone through. I mean, basically, Richard, I think what we need is hope more than, you know, pontificating.
I understand that, you know, we have different approaches in different cultures and religions. Some are more stick and carrot, you know, like if you don't do this, you know, you will smack your bottom. If you do this, you're going to the naughty step. And if you do this, you're going to get a reward. And that's not actually the way I understand energy and understand spirit. But I do understand that we live in a very material world where we think we can buy things. And that's, you know, there's a long tradition. And to a certain extent, when you're talking to somebody who they only understand that, then fine, talk in those terms. An organized religion, you know, has many benefits and it has many drawbacks. What I think is the most useful thing that I think I can say, which is if you're feeling that rush towards suicide, there is only one thing that helps, according to psychologists, or the ones I spoke to, and that's go and be with somebody. Do not be on your own.
Yeah.
Just sit with them. Just say, I can't be on my own now. Just that's all you need to say. And you need to know that you have friends that you can say, I just can't be on my own. And I had an experience in my life where I knew I couldn't be on my own. And I stayed with a friend for a night. I was only like 20, again, about 21. I was just I'd learned that a girlfriend had cheated on me. And it was my first, you know, big big love, and I didn't know. And it was a year after. I didn't know why we'd broken up. And I was absolutely, my world was shaken, and I needed to be with somebody. They didn't need to do anything. Yeah. They didn't just say anything. And that's my segue into the best things that people said to me was like, I don't understand. There is nothing I can say, but I will sit here with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And absolutely. And through this, because I was still studying my degree, and I sat with people in the class, and I'd said, you know, this is my experience. And I told, I met a couple of girls who were suffering from depression. And we'd say, isn't it annoying when people try and cheer you up? It's not like I'm in a bad mood.
Yeah.
This is something else. It's like you can't even understand it. Think I've broken my leg. That's more like you're not going to cheer up a broken leg. So walk it off. Right. So, but then again, sitting, I think very few times, two of us, three of us would just talk about, like, in a way, talk about this. I mean, I didn't want to live at the time. I didn't want to kill myself. That was sorted, but I didn't want to live. And I think that's, you know, part of the grieving process. Although I'm not saying yes to life, I'm saying no to death, but I'm caught in the middle. Mm. And I do believe that Emma's suicide gave me a rebirth. And I think that, you know, if we're at a point of suicide or really contemplating it, then we should consider, okay, this is my chance for a rebirth, to reboot, and say, okay, what do I really want to do? What do I, you know, one I was talking with a lady recently. She was so upset. She's not feeling the same way about her partner, and she tried to kill herself. And I said, and it was really because she didn't want to face, you know, partner and divorce and everything else. I said, don't you think that divorce and suicide, like, that is leaving him? Really, that's really leaving him. Don't you think it would be kind of, in a way, to just leave him, you know? Mm. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, we get our priorities, we say in English, we get our knickers in a twist, and we can't see what's important at that moment in time. And we think, again, I really felt when I've had suicidal ideations, I thought, well, I'll be doing everyone else a favor.
Yeah.
I'm just a burden, especially if I'm having all these troubles. And yet I can tell you from personal experience, like, the grief just doesn't stop for so long, and the guilt, and it doesn't affect one person. It affects a whole, you know, a cluster of people. And of course, I think it, you know, there is a problem with teen suicide, very much a problem with teen suicide. And of course, Emma was 21, but I still feel she falls into the category because she was young.
15 to 24 is the highest age group that has the highest suicide rate. 15 to 24. Those are young people.
Right. To a large extent, explain. This is just my personal belief, like, for getting away from religion, which, you know, really I'm not anti-religion at all. Mm-hmm. I think it's got so many, especially if you focus on Jesus or you focus on that main person and try and get away from the doctrines that other people that have developed over time. Like you said, okay, let's just put this guy who said forgiveness, love, and literally, you know, he told a story about a shepherd that went and spent his whole night looking for one sheep that had gone and got lost. Mm-hmm. He talked about the prodigal son, this one child that had gone away and wanted to return, and how he's so accepted and loved by his father. So Jesus's actual stories that he taught, his actual teachings, like, wow, they are so full of forgiveness and love.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful. So I think, of course, it's open for a group of people to interpret, you know, Jesus's message. And I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm saying, you know, we can, as an individual, have our own opinion, and it's also our freedom to challenge other people's opinions without, you know, necessarily demonizing them. It's like, okay, I get you have this opinion, but I don't see it like that. And I call myself a Christian, but not in those terms. I also call myself a Buddhist as well. Mm. So, you know, that's how open I see it. I see everything as energy. I guess I've got a different take on it.
Richard, how has talking about Emma's suicide been cathartic or helped you heal?
No, I don't think it has. I think it's been very difficult. So I think the healing really come from the relationships, you know, and the time spent doing nothing, believe it or not. And, you know, there used to be almost an acceptance of, in the past, apparently there used to be an acceptance of depression as people going through a change in life, you know, like a reorientation where we just need to try and work some things out. But we live in such a fast society, where, you know, everything's got to be like, wham, bam, thank you, man, you know, app, next thing. So what it has done is, as I said, you know, it gives her life and her death meaning by me talking about it. And I, you know, I mean, and maybe it's the wrong attitude, but if I think, well, if I, by talking, I've saved one life, then it's worth it. And if somebody else had talked before, they would have saved Emma's life. So it's, you know, I can say, well, nobody talked before, I'm not going to do it. No, I think, you know, step up, you know, talk about it. I don't necessarily also want to demonize suicide, but, you know, I think there's a certain, there are certain times if we think about Robin Williams, I think he thought he'd got Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Yeah, I think we can be very fast to judge the act. I suppose there's obviously going to be a portion of people that hear this that literally they feel, yes, I was thinking of it, but now I don't want to do it. And if there's, those are the people that I'm talking to, because I think they've got a wonderful life and a wonderful connection waiting for them. And there's people who, you know, I don't think it's selfish to commit suicide. I think sometimes it's quite deluded. Yeah. I don't think people should feel guilty about it. You know, if we know from psychology, if we repress a thought, if you push down a thought, it doesn't get better. Pushing down thoughts costs you energy. And that means you have less energy to feel joy, happiness, love, and everything else. So you kind of become like a zombie. So we do know that that's the theory, is certainly that if we're able to say, okay, oh, I have a suicidal ideation.
Validate it.
That's not good. That I think we need to do something. We need to do some happy things.
It's a constant battle with these ideations to try to set it aside. It doesn't.
It's a process. It doesn't go away in a snap of a finger.
Yeah,
I think so. And I think, you know, the journey back from depression, if I talk about it myself, it's like daily thinking, you know, I don't want to live. Maybe thinking, you know, how could I kill myself? Or, you know, should I kill myself? To once a week, to once every 2 weeks, once a month, once every 3 months, then just it starts to come. And you know, it's like, it's almost like an echo. It starts to come when it starts to come, until you're just like, wow, I just never think about that anymore.
I love what you said earlier, Richard, when you said that, when you said earlier that I'm not necessarily, because this is exactly how I feel. I just thought about it when you said it, when you said that I'm not necessarily saying yes to life, but at this particular moment, I'm saying no to death. At least for this particular moment. And so, you know, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, but at the moment I'm saying no to death. But for me, not saying necessarily, you know, there's no joie de vivre there.
Right.
But yeah.
And, you know, I suppose there comes a turning point where you say, can I give, like for me, and I don't mean this in any accusatory way at all, but, you know, I said, I can give Emma's death meaning by talking about it and help people. And I suppose, you know, perhaps, you know, this is what you're doing through your grief process, is you're giving your mum's death meaning by talking about it. And you're so once you start connecting, and you see, that's one of the things I think I did right, is I took a lot of vitamin B, because it physically an enormous strain on the body to be to have like a mental trauma, like, you know, suicide or something like that. So I decided, okay, I'm going to take vitamins. And
why B specifically?
B is the kind of the B for the brain. Yeah, it's B for the nerves. And then I had this thing of just, apparently depression is like a social sickness where you're just not meeting people.
Yeah.
And of course, like who wants to be with misery guts? Yeah, basically. So you meet exactly. somebody and they go, you know,
I'm just
going to
be
the
party pooper. I'm just going to bring everybody down.
Do you know how much fun I had with you today? Not that much. And it's like, well, so, you know, when you meet your friends, you don't get the social validation that you're necessarily needing. But I would phone people and I would say, you know, this is a situation. I just want to meet people. I need to meet people. And, you know, I have to give a shout out to Ariel, a very nice yoga teacher in Hong Kong who just met me. And we didn't really know each other. We don't really keep in touch either now. But she, whenever I'd ask her, I'd say, yeah, can I meet up with you? She'd say yes. And we'd go out for dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that lack of closeness allowed her to just hang out with me. And again, a couple of those depressed people, you know, again, because I didn't have family, I was totally on my own. So I just made people, you know, phone them up, said, can we meet up? And of course, I don't think I was the happiest and the nicest person at that time. But, you know, I did very kindly, I've got to give a shout out for Hannah Reedy and the wonderful people at Mind Hong Kong, which is a mental health charity. It's an NGO, really coming from the UK, and they've got a lot of resources in English. So, and she helped me be an advocate, and then she also connected me with the mental health first aid group, and she trained me to be a mental health first aider. And you learn, you know, how people who, you know, have depression, you know, there's one of the great things that they can do is exercise, and another thing they do, and really the exercise and Tai Chi. Rediscovering Tai Chi with my Sifu in Hong Kong was one of the big lifesavers. So reconnecting, you know, embodiment, reconnecting with your body is so important.
And so, Richard, telling us right now that you now have training on how to be a mental health advocate, and over and above that, having gone through this experience with your own daughter, with your own internal battles, how can loved ones, how can parents check on their children? What should we be doing that we're not doing to make sure that people are okay with their mental health?
It's a very difficult question because I think it's nuanced. I haven't gone through the course recently because I've been in Thailand, and the mental health first aid is something which has been licensed only for the country, and so I wouldn't even be allowed to teach in Thailand. But I think one of the things is, you know, we need to connect. I think we all need connection. I think we need validation. And if somebody's not psychotic, you know, most of us need to be helped to calm down. So we find anxiety and depression are very comorbid. So most people that are depressed are also very anxious. But they're not always. In a lot of ways, you know, just meeting up with somebody and asking them to get help, you know, that's good. I think validation is, again, I think, so when somebody says, I have this feeling, we say, I understand you have this feeling. You just have time sitting with somebody and saying, I understand what you're feeling. Can you tell me more? So just hearing about it. And during that training, they had this video of like the nail in the head. Do you know the nail in the head video? Yeah, I think it's called like nail in the forehead or nail in the head. The video starts, this woman's got a nail in her forehead, and she says, I feel so much pain. I feel so much pain. It's like there's a nail in my forehead, and she's got a nail in the forehead, and there's her husband going, I'll pull it out for you. And she's going, look, you don't understand. And then the conversation doesn't really start until they're connecting about what she's really feeling. And he starts to validate, oh, I understand. Yeah. So instead of like being solution-based, like very often people want to go, let me fix that. Yeah. Men, hello. Yeah, this is one of our things. Yeah, okay, I'm going to fix that. You're depressed. Okay, let me fix it. You don't have a boyfriend. You don't have money. You don't have a girlfriend. You don't have money. You don't have like. I'm going to fix all this. Yeah, actually, it's not that. It's, you know, really just connecting, being with somebody. Like I got so much support from sitting with depressed people because they didn't want to fix me.
Yeah,
they just knew that we felt the same way, and it was okay. It was okay to feel like that. And we could say, you know, if you said, I feel really, really bad today, they'd say, okay, that's okay to feel really, really bad today. And, you know, not even you'll get through it. It's like, it's okay. You might feel bad tomorrow as well. And I'll meet up with you tomorrow and I'll sit with you and I'll do this however long, you know, this takes. Because before then, we were feeling bad and hiding it and not being able to express it and be part of a community and be connected. So just even just saying to your loved ones, like, oh yeah, I'm feeling bad. I think it has a wonderful healing connection. And I wonder, I mean, how often have you had that experience of saying, I feel bad, and somebody saying, yeah, okay, I hear you. I hear you feeling bad. It's okay. You're worthwhile. You're worthwhile just being here feeling bad. That's enough for me. I just wanted to share this one little sort of spooky story, because kind of a nice story. And of course, some people may think, you know, it's all witchcraft and demons and so on. But for me, no, it's not. I understand they have that belief. And I think, you know, they have that belief to protect themselves. And I think it's probably a good thing. But I wanted to have a connection with my daughter through somebody else. So I contacted the medium. And literally, as soon as she had contact, I just couldn't stop crying. So it really wasn't a contact that was useful for me. But one day I was in Mongkok at my home, and it was middle of the day, and an owl, you remember I had that journey with the owl?
Yes.
An owl hooted, and there are no owls in Mongkok, as far as I know. And it was in the middle of the day, and I felt like this was my daughter just letting me know that she was there. And I felt a bit crazy, and I was on the mental health first aid course, and somebody said, you know, has anybody had an auditory, so a hallucination they can hear? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, yeah. Well, if you're in 6 months of grieving, that's not considered as psychotic. They don't consider that as mentally ill. They actually think that's normal.
That's normal.
So again, I'm like, I love it that our psychology is open to that. And then I'm reminded, I went to, like a few months later, I went to India to teach Tai Chi. And outside the house where I was staying, sitting on the ledge, just so I could see it, was this owl in the middle of the day, just sitting there. So these wonderful little symbols, you know, sometimes these little signs that Emma, she couldn't be there, but she could send an owl, one of her friends, to go and stand there for me. And I think we can look at that as, you know, many ways. You know, we don't really know the sum of who we are, and we are supported in so many ways beyond what we think. And again, it goes back to these wonderful messages. I mean, I know if for some people it's going to be like, how can you quote Jesus? But I was brought up in that tradition and this wonderful story of this shepherd. He spends his whole night going after that one sheep that had lost its way. And, you know, we just have to remember that. And again, prodigal son, like this is real Jesus doctrine, not anybody else that followed him afterwards. It's like, that's what the man said.
Yeah.
And I think that's so kind. And especially as, you know, for my story, Jesus came to me. I wasn't looking for him. I was like, you know, before Emma died, I was looking to, you know, Guangong or Guan Yin or Buddha or whatever. But the one that had had a good access to me was Jesus. And I was like, well, that's an enormously compassionate. And it hasn't changed my attitude towards Buddhism. And I haven't become a fundamentalist, but I love to witness for it, because he came in such a down-to-earth way that I could, you know, connect to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I noticed life had to stop after Emma died and restart. And really it has. I don't like to say I'm completely healed, because as I said, you know, maybe I have like one of these lows again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean,
and that's okay,
say,
right?
You know, exactly. But the nice thing is, in a way, I'm a witness to, yes, and it, you know, it can get better. I think the tendency is for it to get better.
And I ask this because this is in acknowledgement that everybody's journey is different, and bereavement by suicide can also be prolonged. The impact of isolation and guilt following a suicide can last for years. And so I just wanted to set aside any assumptions, you know, regarding mourning periods or mourning patterns. I mean, some people might say that, oh, it's been 5 years, you should be okay now, but it's everybody's journey is different.
Yeah, it's weird, because again, Emma's life, if I look at it, she did things in her life, a very I'd say not very short, in her short life, she traveled all around the world. She left home, you know, for a summer holiday at 15, went to Italy, visited, you know, an anarchistic village. She worked on farms everywhere. And when we last met in Hong Kong, I met her for a holiday. We had a holiday together, just beautiful holiday together. It's just a wonderful memory. And when we were saying goodbye in Hong Kong, she decided to go to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I said, like, I'm never gonna see you again. I don't want you to go. Don't go. Just don't go. I can't forget knowing or saying it. And so there's these funny things. If I look at, again, I look at the whole thing, I could see if I wanted to, it's part of a plan. So I could see a certain greatness to somebody in a way like Emma, who took a part in a bigger plan, to have perhaps with that intention that I would get on, you know, on your podcast and explain all of my experiences.
Tell our listeners about your podcast again. What's it called?
It's called Discover Energy Work. It's just the idea that, you know, where your mind goes, energy flows. And, you know, some people have learned to develop that to a good degree. And I help people with that. That's what I do, coaching them, because I needed help with the grief. And that was part of my therapy. I didn't do any traditional psychotherapy. I've only done energy work. So I want to help people understand that when they're having psychic experiences, that they're not alone. And so I'm sharing people's stories, their own sort of psychic experiences. And I've done that I've talked to people who are working in the US military in America, the Remote Viewing Project.
Yes.
They employed for like 20 years psychic spies and ran scientific studies. So psychic, again, is something which is, there's a lot of evidence pointing to this dimension of ourselves. And that's just part of the broad spectrum of what being psychic is. So for me, it's a very exciting thing. And there's a lot of work to be done, which needs to be done in my community, which is the psychic community. But also, you know, an outreach to try and sort of help people understand, like, when we're not crazy, yeah. But by the way, crazy carries a stigma and our psychic carries as much of a stigma. But as I said, like, for me, I was psychic and depressed, and that means I've got a double stigma.
A double whammy.
That's
just
right.
It's like being gay and depressed.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I can totally relate to that.
Queer and depressed. Yeah. Anyway, well, we stand with you in loving silence, Richard, in admiration for coming onto the project to open your heart and speak your truth. Because in reality, I think that we acknowledge that the answers that we tried to seek about suicide are the answers that survivors like you are still trying to find in full. So we really are very, very grateful to you for coming on, and to Emma as well for allowing you to tell her story and your story as well.
Yes. I mean, whenever I think of Emma now, I just smile. I just got a big smile on my face, which is that. And that's, I hope, can be some hope for some people. But I mean, I'm so happy that you're doing this, because I feel like it's a really, really important thing. It's a really important topic we need to talk about. So thank you so much as well.
Just been served. This has been the Balut Kiki Project. Uniquely Pinoy, unapologetically queer. We are now declaring this project complete.
Thank you for clicking play. Don't forget to subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast streaming platform. And leave us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed the show.